Hey, it's me. Real quick before we start the episode, I have to apologize to my friend Dave Rosenblatt. I teased at the end of last week's episode that my conversation with him would be up next. But something came up, and for reasons I feel should be obvious, I decided to change this week's episode to my conversation with Natalia Noble about Star Wars. So David, I love you, and your episode will drop next week. But for now, please enjoy this. If you're a human person born any time in the last 100 years, my guess is there's a good chance you've got tickets to see Episode 9 of the Skywalker Saga this weekend. Even if you don't even like Star Wars that much, or just don't really have an opinion one way or another, I'm willing to bet you've still got a ticket. I love a good fandom. There are all different kinds that I subscribe to. I'm a big sports head, basketball and football mostly. But I'll watch an exciting playoff game in almost any sport if there's enough drama and a good storyline. I love comic books and superheroes. I'm a DC guy at heart, but Marvel's cinematic universe is an achievement I didn't think I'd see in my lifetime that nearly had me changing teams. Love a good Lord of the Rings marathon as much as the next nerd. Never quite did get into anime, though I understand the appeal. But I feel like there's perhaps no cultural phenomenon that is as far-reaching and as widely known and beloved as Star Wars. Even though there's almost been nothing but division as to the quality of the film since basically the release of the very first one, yes, people didn't like Empire when it was first released, these are facts. This franchise, nay, this global superpower, nay, this galactic empire seems impervious to all of it. And now, with Disney at the helm and no end to Star Wars brand content in sight, Star Wars is possibly even bigger than ever before. And that's saying a lot. Because growing up in the era that saw the theatrical release of the special editions and the prequels, Star Wars was already, far and away, the biggest, baddest franchise on the block. My personal fandom started early and strong. I was a big collector of the action figures. My friends and I would often call our local Toys R Us and Walmart to find out when the new shipment of newly minted figures would be coming in so we could show up right as the employees were opening the giant cardboard box they were delivered in. We'd grab them straight out of the box before they even hit the shelves. Didn't want to be the last kid on my street to snag a rare Bossk or IG-88. We did this so often that the people at the stores knew our names. That's right. I don't nerd out because it's hip. I was nerding out before I even knew what hip was, alright? But I have to say, as red hot as my fanfare is and was, my friend Natalia puts mine to shame. Her knowledge of the ins and outs of the Star Wars universe is thorough and built on a foundation of pure love for the characters and the actors and writers and thousands of artists who help bring them to life. You'll hear in this interview just how much this thing means to her. And here's the thing. I know she's not alone. I know she's not an outlier or a weirdo. When she sits down this weekend to, once and for all, finish the final installment of the three mirror trilogies George Lucas said he wanted to build more than 40 years ago, she, like me, will be in very good company. Now, I have absolutely no grand delusions that everyone is going to like this film. I'm almost certain that there will be a good amount of division and a healthy dose of outrage from some, because that's Star Wars. And because that's what passionate fans do. They care so much about the thing that eventually almost nothing is good enough for those characters. Personally, after the prequels, I just decided to turn my brain and expectations all the way off and just hope for a movie that was enjoyable and fun and not to think too much about how it could have been better. And that's been working for me. I really enjoyed the latest installments, and I'm betting I'll enjoy this last one. But in preparing to talk to Natalia about our favorite film series, I couldn't help but wonder, is Star Wars only popular because it's cool? Is it just mindless entertainment intended to be enjoyed without too much overthinking? Just eat your popcorn and enjoy the guns that go pew pew and the laser swords and the telekinetic space magic? Or is there more to it? Natalia seems pretty convinced that there is actually a whole hell of a lot more to it. So, from a Blanket Fort recording studio in my one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today my friend Natalia Noble and I are talking about Star Wars.
I'm really nervous.
How do you feel?
I feel great. I feel ready. I'm ready.
Pumped up. Oh my god. Yeah, there's so much to cover. I feel like. Hopefully, we get through all of it.
Yeah, so much to talk about.
What's the first time that you ever remember? I mean, what you said you saw. The special editions in theaters, but that wasn't the first time you'd seen Star Wars, was it?
No, it was not.
What was the first time you saw Star Wars?
First time I saw Star Wars was in an apartment that my parents owned that I also lived in, just happened to be in the same apartment.
You happened to live.
I happened to be in the same one. No, and my dad had the original trilogy. I remember the colors very distinctly on the box. It was before 1997's release of the special editions, which everyone remembers, I think, that video cassette series of like the gold spine special edition.
Yeah.
This was before that. Old THX logo with red, purple, and green for, and we had just, you know, and they weren't episode 4, 5, and 6. It was just New Hope. And then we have, I think if I remember the boxes correctly,
That's right. Did they not say 4, 5, and 6 before the special edition?
No, they did not say that.
I think I remember people talking about that. Yeah. Because people would be like, no, that wasn't 4, 5, and 6. And then they even added the 4 and the 5 and 6
yep.
to the title crawl.
Then. Yep. Uh-huh. And so before this, So,
because can you imagine if the movie had come out in
1977, it was like Star Wars. It was just Star Wars.
And can you imagine if it had said episode 4 and everyone in the audience is like,
did I miss something? Yeah.
Were there 3 others of these?
Yes.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yes, I saw them probably back. Uh-huh. No.
Yeah.
It was just Star Wars. Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back, and Return of the Jedi, but we have, you know, it's New Hope and Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. But at least in that, those in the video cassettes, no numbers, just the titles. And it was the original films transferred to video cassette. And I was a very, very young, impressionable child at the time. And my first true memory of this of the series, you know, I'd watch you when you go and rewatch it.
Give
you
me
watch
one second.
It, yeah.
It's loud.
The show.
Yep.
Sorry. Oh, you're fine.
All right, I'm not going to edit any of that out. It's just going to be
okay.
3 minutes of me walking around and saying, no, that's not. No, you were saying, though. Sorry, we were talking about the first year, exposure.
My first exposure.
It was A New Hope. It wasn't episode 4. It was a video cassette. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yeah. Video cassette.
Apartment where you lived apartment. That also happened to
my parents
contain,
were also there. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. This is before even my little sister was born that I saw this video cassette. So I was not even 5 yet when I first saw this. And I had this incredible visceral reaction to beep, bam, ba-da-da, 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 and the title crawl the music was so powerful to me that it just it sent me into a new experience, and it's something I wasn't expecting. And as we get our first glimpse of the rebel ship escaping from the Star Destroyer, even then I was just totally sucked in. Mm-hmm. And I had already loved Legos, blocks, all sorts of building toys, and I saw it, and in my little childlike mind, I didn't see this amazing special effect that would have blown people's minds back in 77. I was like, these look like toys that I love. These look like Legos that are flying. Yeah. That's what they looked like models, because they were. Mm-hmm. And there was something beautiful and entrancing about that even. It was like watching
the intricacy of
grown-ups playing with these toys or something, with lights and lasers flying out of them, and I was completely sucked in from that moment forward. But of course for me, it was all about Leia when I was a little kid.
What do you think made that first movie what it was? You talked about that. I mean, what a way to start a movie. Movies used to have these long overtures, even, you know, like when they would, you know, the old movie musical would do the full overture and stuff like that. And like a Ben-Hur has an overture. And,
yeah, so you could recognize the themes later.
I think in the 60s and 70s, though, they were getting away from that. Like the early 70s and like the 60s, they were getting away from the long.
Yes.
I don't necessarily think that the title crawl is an overture, because you are reading, you're into the narrative at that point. It's not just like you know, opening credits and saying who made the movie and stuff, and we're listening to the soundtrack. It's like, no, we're right into it. And that's, I think, something right there, the way that those movies just, you get that little brief breath of a long time ago, and again, you know, that everyone's so familiar with the cadence of it now at this point, when you go see, you know, The Force Awakens or The Last Jedi, like we're all so familiar with the cadence of the 20th Century Fox fanfare playing, and then I think Lucasfilm comes first, then 20th Century Fox, then it goes to black, and then like the blue lettering coming up, and then like the hush, and everyone's waiting, and it's almost like a roller coaster. But do you think people felt it like that? I mean, because you talked about it as a kid, the first time when no one knew it was coming,
What was it like to be sitting there? I think about that all the time. I get so jealous of someone who got the chance to see it. In its original form, as it came out, as it premiered. I have no idea what that would be like. I had a new sense of that when I was a kid with Phantom Menace, with the prequels, and then again with Force Awakens and the sequels. So, I'll never know. I'll never know exactly what it was like for them, but I do know what it was like for me. And it was, even as a child, just something that gripped me. I didn't hit that same feeling until I went to the first film I ever saw in cinema was Beauty and the Beast, the animated feature, and that was brilliant, of course. Mm-hmm. And then the second time that I had that very powerful feeling that was reminiscent of Star Wars was Jurassic Park, seeing that in theaters. And again, that's familiar to all of us as well. Steven Spielberg and George Lucas were working on a lot of the same mythologies back in the day, and then you have John Williams' score again, and that is the big powerful punch.
Yeah, I think I saw that in theaters like 3 or 4 times. This was the first time I can remember seeing a movie several times.
Yes.
In the theater was Jurassic Park.
Right.
I remember we kept going back to it. We saw it at the drive through, and like that was great to be in the car, like when they're trapped in the car. And
Oh, so powerful. So great. The first time that you see that the Brontosaurus coming up the music
so
score.
Magical. But I want, maybe it was that in the 70s that made this so iconic, but
I think it was a return to form in a lot of ways. When you were talking about what that opening credit mm-hmm. the title crawl, as they call it, the title crawl, for me, and I think for anyone else that's worked in theater or for a long time, it is a prologue. In the beginning of Romeo and Juliet, you have a prologue. In the beginning of these great Greek tragedies, the Orestia, there's a prologue beforehand. And that was cementing it, I think, in the minds of anyone that was going to see it, whether subconsciously or consciously, as this is a piece of new mythology. You are being welcomed into, when we say in a galaxy far, far away, and we say, have preface that even with a long time ago, and what you're seeing is of this futuristic world that that we can't even, that we're only fantasizing about.
Even that is so bizarre. There's so much. It's so bizarre to say a very long time ago. And I think
Family Guy, in a place with laser swords and laser guns.
I think Family Guy makes fun of it. It's like a long time ago, but somehow still in the future.
I think,
like,
yes, that's a perfect joke.
But I love world building where you just get dropped into the world and there's little to no feeling of on the writer's part to say, like, to explain where this is in relation to you or like how this relates to your world. It just, this is what it is. And you get that feeling with Lord of the Rings, like in Tolkien's worlds, where you just kind of get dropped in. And
yeah,
it's like,
another,
and here it
another
is.
Fantastic and, yeah, prologue.
I mean, we get dropped in and at the beginning of A New Hope. And it's like, they're just saying things like the Rebel Alliance is on the run from the Empire. And we're like, yes, of course.
Yes,
we
were shaking our heads. Of course, that makes complete sense.
I know what they're talking about.
Yeah, and that also works so well, too. I think, so something that I think about a lot is how every set of these three films, this circle cycle, is very reflective of the time period and where we're coming out of. So in the 1970s, as you mentioned, movies weren't doing that anymore. Movies weren't giving us these great big overtures or these huge title crawls and prefacing the film with this historical event.
Have movies ever done title crawl?
Like, I think of title screens, many of them, I think of classics like Casablanca, like explaining to us the history where we're at.
Yeah.
So that was always a thing of older classic films. And of course, that's where George Lucas grew up. That's what he grew up with. So he's trying to, I think that he was trying to cement it immediately as reminiscent. It's futuristic.
Yeah.
It's using the height of technology at the time in terms of special effects, but it's reminiscent of films in the 40s and 50s coming out of that period of World War II. And then again, with hitting us with the Korean War, and then again with the Vietnam War, it was trying to say we were in a cynical period in the 70s of economic depression and of social depression, where we had been lied to by a government going into using our forces as an outside force to come into other spaces to try to direct the course of history and to keep communism from, you know, spreading. I think people wanted to go back. They had seen 2001 A Space Odyssey. They had seen Apocalypse Now. They had seen films that were relational to their cynicism and their fear of what was coming next.
Mm-hmm.
And what was really needed in that time was a new hope, a return to an epoch of hope. When you say that you've got a rebel alliance fighting an empire, that is like, well, immediately I'm placed back into a time of the hope of what we were doing when we were involved in World War II. What rebel alliances at that time, before even the U.S. became involved, were doing to fight the empire, to fight the spread of... Gosh, Nazi symbolism is everywhere in the original trilogy. And again, now...
Down to the shape of the helmets.
Absolutely. He was absolutely playing with that. I think not to go off on too big of a tangent for it, but when he was editing the film, his wife actually was the editor then at the time, George Lucas's wife of the film, when they were editing the film, he would give the team shots of dogfights, of captured dogfights from World War II, and say, like, I want it to look like this with the X-Wings fighting TIE fighters. And there's so much excitement and punch and power into these cuts from, like, this one's going down. Ah, no, look at this one's coming up. It was just trying to relate us back to an epoch of hope where we are fighting this small, really defenseless force is fighting against something that is truly transgressively evil, and they have to stop it. And we have to put in our lot with these young adventurers and hope that they have the wherewithal and the can-do attitude to get it done. And that was then. And what I felt when I was watching these characters, you have your naive, callow, hopeful youth in Luke. You have your pirate with the romantic heart of gold, our Byronic hero in Han Solo. You have the wizened old sage who is willing to share and spread his wisdom with you in Obi-Wan. And you have, yes, for me, I was like, you know, the next step is damsel in distress. You're Sleeping Beauty, as it were. It's someone that has to be saved. But when he walks into that room, aren't you a little short for a Star Trooper? With the way that she says it too,
that you're like, oh, it's the tone of her voice. It's the way that you're just like, oh, she's not.
She doesn't need anybody.
Well, even before then, we were sort of introduced to this person who's like, don't blow up my home planet. You know, like, and then the neck, but it's like, even that seems like it was, we were being made to think, oh, she's going to be this lilting, like, my planet blew up and I need Obi-Wan. He's my only hope.
I know.
And then all of a sudden she stands, aren't you a little short to be a stormtrooper?
With a different accent,
into the garbage chute, fly boy. You know, it's like she, it's a...
Well, somebody's got to save our skins.
Yeah.
Everything that she says is golden. I memorize it as a kid. I still have it memorized when I think about it, when I see her in my mind's eye. But before that, I think a kind of interesting little segue to that with that lilting kind of... You know, I thought I remembered your foul stench when you came on board. Carrie Fisher was trained in England. Her mom's Debbie Reynolds. We all know this.
Yeah.
Carrie Fisher was trained as an actress.
Isn't there a story where she talks about like how she was doing a weird accent?
It wasn't on purpose. She had been trained in... She was only, again, a magnificent mind and talent. Mm-hmm. She was 19 when she was cast in this. Youngest in the cast. But then the intelligence there and the adaptation for character there. When you see these, I recommend anyone listening to this podcast, please go and watch the Carrie Fisher audition tapes. Watch people auditioning for Star Wars and listen to the way that she wraps around the language compared to any other woman or even any other man auditioning for this. And there's a mastery there because she is just that intelligent. If you can read some of her books, please do. If you are an addict struggling or someone struggling with mental illness, please listen to her autobiography. Please listen to her books and you will find some hope there as well. But she was trained in England, going to acting school there till she was 18, and then auditioned for the movie. And when everyone, all of that production, the production that you see that isn't in Tunisia, that the stuff that isn't on the planet of Tatooine that's happening in space, all happened in sound stages in London. So everyone around her is a British actor, a British great. And when she's around that accent, it would start just coming out. The British side would start coming out to where she's dropping R's. And I thought, when you came on board, we have a little bit of a drop there. But then when she's gets in these scenes with Harrison Ford and Mark Hamill, who are as American as apple pie, that kind of that American sassy side, aren't you a little short for a stormtrooper? It comes out much harder.
I think it's kind of fun to even think of, though, like, how she might posture as...
Exactly. I always use it as that.
When she's being very official in front of the generals and she's being...
Her accent
Princess
is
Leia
of Alderaan.
From Alderaan. That she's putting on this... And then in front of these other guys, it's like, hey, like, get out of my way.
I think of that too, and I think it's just so perfectly... Even if it wasn't completely intentional, that was there, and that element is there. And I love it. It's like the secret. We get to see... It's dramatic irony. We see her as she presents to these people as a representative and as an ambassador, and there is so much strength and character there and character of mind. And then when she's around these like low blow, Joe Blow, technicians and a pilot, it's all sass.
These nerf herders.
Yes.
I think it's so remarkable that this movie didn't wind up just being a one-off kind of forgettable B movie of the 70s that's like a cult hit that like people are like, have you ever seen Star Wars? And people are like, no, I've never heard of it. And they like pull it out and they're like, oh, this movie's great. And they describe it just in the way that you just did. And they're like, the great thing is that Carrie Fisher, like they go through it, but like no one's ever heard of it really. It's like just this thing that like a few, like it's amazing because it so easily could have. It's so easy, and so it, thinking about it, because it's now this massive thing that it is, it's this cultural institution, it's this international phenomenon, and it has been for 50, 60 years. It's amazing. I think that there's, like, looking at it, it's like, how did that happen? And you just did such a good job of talking about, like, the place that we were in, where we needed the hope to get out of the cynicism and using the symbology of the Second World War. And we had just gotten out of Vietnam and all this stuff. I think it's amazing thinking about people like Peter Cushing and thinking about the way that he got his actors to buy in to this.
Ugh.
Because you listen to the interviews of people sometimes who read the script and they were like, oh, what the hell am I? What is this
I think
thing?
Carrie Fisher said it best in that you can write this, George, but you can't say it.
Yeah, so. Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. And it's amazing that he got these people to
Alec Guinness!
And he got them to buy in, you know, and got them to at least, I mean, they were pros and they were you know, not going to deliver a shitty performance. But I think about this with the Lord of the Rings movies a lot, where it's like there are movies that exist in this realm where it's like you are on such a thin line between just like a hair further and it's totally absurd and we can't go there with you and I can't suspend my disbelief anymore and I can't go along on the ride because it's too stupid and it's too cheesy and it's too corny. Just a hair further. But you stay just on that right side of it.
Exactly.
And it's excellent. And it's like you're just on the right side of too corny. And in this case, he flirts with that line so much. But there's so much that's so great, like we just talked about, the way the movie begins, that it's like, how many movies do you watch that have you hooked that immediately?
You know, what you just said, it is buying into it. And I think it is the idea of
how the
it
hell does
being
he
mythology.
Get John Williams? How does this young filmmaker with who's only done, I mean, had he done American Graffiti before this? Or was this
American Graffiti was first. That is how he got the chance to do Star Wars.
Yeah.
Do a Star War.
How does he get, like, he gets John Williams. He gets, you know, it's like, yeah, the Alec Guinness, the Peter Cushings, and like the effects crew, it's like so many things could have and should have been against him.
You get a chance, if anyone listening to this gets a chance, please watch. I think it's actually now on Disney Plus. This is not a plug. They're not paying me. I wish they were. I need money so that I can go see this next Star Wars
People
film.
People Pleaser brought to you by Disney Plus.
Yes.
You hear that, Disney? Send me over some of that Star Wars money.
I need a Star Wars money.
Yeah.
If you go to Disney Plus, you can watch Empire of Dreams. You can watch sort of...
Oh, I've heard that's a good one.
It's a fantastic documentary.
The one I watched that blew my mind was The People versus George Lucas.
Oh, that is the best.
Where you really get to see like the transformation of him from like young, idealistic artist to
representative of the Empire.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I got to thank him because I get to the end of a movie and there's Lucasfilms, there's Skywalker Ranch, there's a Skywalker Sound in almost every one of my favorite movies. He has a hand in it. THX 1193 Productions.
Mm-hmm.
It's all from him, from that, the beginnings of this. But yes, I think what you just said about buying into the world, I think that there's something so primal. We have been doing it. I mentioned prologues earlier with the prologues that Shakespeare will use in a play, or the prologues mm-hmm. that will happen even further back into a Greek chorus giving you the prologue. There is something primal about hero's journey. If you get a chance to watch Empire of Dreams, or to please read some Joseph Campbell, who was a big mentor of George Lucas's, and he is someone that was deeply embedded into the world of comparative mythologies as well as comparative religion, and he developed the concept. Not that he developed it; it's more like he was just dissecting and letting it be known of the hero's journey. That is such a it's a part of every one of humanity's basic.
Is this the same person that said that there's like seven?
There's yes,
or
yeah. There's
seven
just
or
a,
nine.
Yeah. Of basic story types. And
every time I hear that, I'm like, fuck off. Get out of
there's
here.
There's got to be more.
Yeah.
But I think of, you know, not to diverge from Star Wars very much, but something that was very relatively new, Harry Potter. Mm-hmm. Harry Potter, you got yourself, is another one of these that was a major cultural upheaval to young children. It's the hero's journey of what? I'm a wizard? What? Like, what?
Yeah.
I'm a Jedi? What? What?
There's that too. So there's that element of it. So one of my questions I was going to ask, so you answered the question brilliantly. I even wrote down, I said, what made the first movie great? Is it deep or simple? And I think that I think you've made a great argument for like the depth that exists in there and also the simplicity of it. But like, there's that element. I'm a wizard. The Force.
Yes.
Like this thing.
Ah!
This, because that, I was thinking about this the other day, and I was like, that's the element, though. That's the rub, where it's like, you've got all these great characters, and you've got all this great...
How many midichlorians do you have, Austin? Do you have a lot? Yeah, is the count over 20,000?
Off the charts. What does he say? Yeah. We've never seen this movie. Like...
Okay, insane. I forgive him for midichlorians.
Midichlorians, my God.
I get it. The force, I get it. It's all, you know, it's all physical, it's biological, connected to the spiritual. I get it.
But like, that was the thing, I think, that for me, as a young boy, was like, that's the coolest shit in the world. Are you
like, I can just lift X-Wings with my mind.
And like, we, the way that it evolves over the movies, we can talk about that. We can talk about like the way, especially lately, the way that the force just continues to surprise us. And like, I guess you can just have a bubble.
Astro projections around, now.
Like, you have a bubble around yourself in space and not die, and then Mary Poppins fly back to your spaceship.
If it's like, within 30 seconds, you can do it.
But is that the rule?
That's how much like lung, you know, lung power you got. About, you got about 30 seconds before you start to boil and die. I think it's how much, you know, lung.
I'll have to ask my
have.
Cousin who works for NASA, like, how quickly I die if I'm in space.
She's also powerful with the force. So.
She's also quite powerful with the force, yes. But this, that idea, that introduction to that thing, because otherwise, I mean, if you take that out of the movie, if you just say it's like, everything else is exactly the same. There are Jedi Knights, there's these guys that like fight with lightsabers, and they're like trained to fight good with these things, and everything else is the same. Darth Vader's this like really scary guy, but like he doesn't choke anyone with telekinesis, and there is no such thing as the force, but like everything else is the same. I think, I don't know, maybe that's the thing that keeps it in the realm of like, this is a really cool kind of lost cult B movie, but there's something to me about, and I don't know.
There's something transcendent about the force.
I don't know that the force is the thing that makes it, but like, that's the thing where you're like, I gotta know more about that. Like, I got, like, what?
I want the secrets. The sacred texts!
The sacred texts! That was the disappointing thing about the midichlorians, too, is it's like, no, I want to know more, but also I don't. And that leads me into the next thing I want to talk about is, we do live in the universe where Star Wars wasn't just like a sleeper B movie that never got another movie made after it, and only a few people. We live in the universe where it is what it is. Sequel problem. I've been thinking about sequels a lot lately, and like, I love that original trilogy. But it seems like the problem with sequels is you're always so excited. Like, ooh, it's my favorite people again. Here they are in the new thing. But the problem is, all that stuff you had imagined for them is now concrete. It's like, no, it is this. Yeah. This is what happened. Do you think that as much as we love Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, that maybe it all would have been more pure left to just this one perfect thing where they blow up the Death Star at the end of the movie, and this and all the hope that can exist with that like medal ceremony at the end where it's like, and then they go off to do whatever you can imagine they do. Right. And we even know that we didn't see Darth Vader die. We just saw him kind of spin away.
That would be like stopping at the Old Testament. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how to even answer that, because I've never lived in a space where I was waiting for the next chapter of the story. Not for the original trilogy. Yeah. I didn't see the 1977 premiere and then wait to get to Empire and then wait again to get to Jedi.
But it's just because now we're in a place where like it seems like we're going to be making Star Wars movies.
I know, and that is ad nauseum. That is heartbreaking.
And it seems like we're going to explore every, because I mean, and look, I'm very happy that Empire Strikes Back exists and that Return of the Jedi exists. I'm very happy that a lot of the movies exist, but like, getting to like Solo and stuff, there was just information I was getting that I just was like, oh, I never cared.
Were you a fan of before the purchase by Disney, were you a fan of the extended universe in books, comics, video games?
I was when I was growing up. I read comic books and like books. Like, I remember reading a book that was just about the guy who raised the Rancor monster.
Right.
And like about his, and then like when I watched that movie now,
I read my favorite was the Jedi Academy. I was all up in the kids' business.
I love that stuff. I loved But I don't know. There was, like, seeing the information, I'm like, oh, I didn't care how Lando came to like capes so much. Or that he always did. Like, I wasn't, like, watching Empire Strikes Back going, what's with that guy's cape? Like, I know, you know, like, sometimes it's like we get so many sequels that you're starting to answer questions that I never had. And you're starting to, like, make things concrete that I'm like, oh, I kind of liked having the Kessel Run as this thing in my head of, like, what does that mean? And now I know what it means. And, like...
See, I totally see what you're saying, but as someone who grew up with not having enough Star Wars, at least for, as a child when I was very young, before we get Phantom Menace coming out,
yeah.
Not having enough, I was so interested in the extended universe. So I was getting my hands on the library on every Star Wars book and filling up my banks of Star Wars imagination land with other ideas, with other concepts about what the Empire was, what their ultimate goal was going to be, with what relationships would be like between Luke, Han, and Leia going forward past Jedi. So I was always inundating myself with more media, with the caveat within my mind that this is not technically official. None of this is official. These are just other people's ideas about what could be happening and letting that entertain me. And I think I still do that. I think one of the hardest parts for a lot of people, a lot of the fandom to let go of when Disney purchased it was like, well, what happens to the EU? Does he still marry Mara Jade? Like, there's a lot of stuff. And it's like, well, no, he never married Mara Jade, buddy. Like, that was someone else's concept of what was happening. And it's you are allowed to keep playing in that space. The pieces are there.
But so that's what I'm, I guess, trying to get at is, like, yeah. Does the concreteness of canon films coming out,
yes.
And like new sequels and new things coming out, does it take away,
I think that's
a bit
where...
of the ownership of like, oh, but I had my own
but
way.
But it was
of
my
how...
way of finishing it off.
And but also it's like, but we want stories finished, you know?
I agree.
You're seeing this with the Harry Potter universe too, where when we start getting more,
it's too much.
We actually wanted those seven. We wanted the Harry Potter story told. And that's how I feel about the Skywalker saga. I'm all right with, hey, we're about to wrap up the Skywalker saga. But every time we head into new territory, I'm like, oh, geez, but I wanted this story finished. But also it's like, I think 4, 5, and 6 could be it. And I think a lot of people, it's like, that could be it. And that's not to say that I wasn't one of the billions of people who was, you know, so excited for episode 1. I was, and I went and saw it, and I loved it. I was 11 years old, and I thought that lightsaber duel was the coolest thing I'd ever seen in my entire life. And, yeah, fighting next to those big, like, light columns and the, you know, and they, again, the Force can do new things. Like, right off the bat in that movie, I'm like, oh, they can jump really, really high? I didn't know that. I guess in The Empire Strikes Back, there's that quick little thing of Luke jumping high.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like, I was so excited for those movies, and then I saw them, and then you go, oh, that's who Darth Vader is when he's a little kid? Oh, that... And that's not just, like, someone else's conception of it. That's canon.
That's the story.
That guy in that mask, that's what he was like when he was a little kid. He was like, I'm a pod race, and you know, it's
working.
Poor Jake Lloyd. His life was really hurt by those
you know,
movies.
He's such a part of my life because Jingle All the Way is a big favorite, too.
You love Jingle All the Way?
Love Jingle All the Way.
I had
course.
One of those
You got the toy of Turbo Man.
Yeah, Turbo Man. Turbo Man. Yep, I had a Turbo Man.
Oh, Jake
I also
Lloyd.
Had so many Star Wars toys.
Oh, my favorite memory. Even as a child, again, I didn't love a lot of Phantom Menace because I did not feel the same connection to the characters that I had had, the visceral connection to the characters that I had.
Thing you were looking for of like, who's going to be my new...
Yes, who's... again, I was hoping for the next Leia for me. I was hoping for that character that was going to imbibe... the life around this fantasy space world around her and imbibe that and then release something modern about what it meant to be a woman in this space. I wanted some of that. I wanted some of that punch, some of that action, some of that sarcasm, some of that autonomy. And while also being this again, she's got to be everything to all people. It's the Madonna whore complex. So she's also beautiful, funny, so desirable, and then but doesn't take any shit from anyone. That was what I was hoping for. And then we get Padme, and there's
before we get into the prequels too much, I want to first take a stop off at, so okay, timeline wise, we have, you have the VHSs with the blue, purple, and yes, green lightsabers on them. You have the original titles of the movies. You watch those. You get into extended universe. When do you see special editions in theaters?
Ooh, right before Phantom Menace comes out. So right before 97.
Yeah, because I remember those being really big. That was a big deal.
It was a massive, massive deal to me.
My parents telling me, like, you guys, you don't realize how big these movies were when they came out before you were born, you know? And then I get to go do that with my parents. I get to go see...
Mind blown. Mind blown.
I loved all three of them so much.
Yes, I did pick up on the differences. I didn't immediately as a child, because I was pretty young watching the re-releases in cinema. I didn't pick up immediately on the changing of Han shooting first.
I didn't
enter my mind.
I saw the bigger things more obviously. Yes. Like some of the, you know, shots of X-Wings going by that you're like, oh, that's different.
Whoa,
you know,
that's a computer generated image. Right. Yeah, that was
where I remember as a kid thinking it was so cool.
I loved it too.
And there's certain things that are cooler, like the Death Star explosions, just cooler. It just is. But there's also, you as an adult, I watch it and I'm like, it is so odd, the overlaying of
I don't get it.
Modern and like bad 90s CGI imagery.
I went to go see I was still in Utah. I went to go see the Utah Symphony play the original orchestrations and score to A New Hope while the film played. And I was hoping for the original movie, but because they can't play them. Yeah. It's of course the special edition. And right as the first special edition shot of a stormtrooper riding in the desert, and the big lumbering CGI shot goes by, I went, ugh. It was totally unintentional. It was just something that came out of me as a reaction, and it was so loud while this entire...
It echoed through a Bravenel hall. I don't know where you saw it.
Yes, in Bravenel, and my whole... I was bright red as everyone looked over it, like, what happened
to her? But really, it's even more bizarre that he went and made the move of, like, no, you can't get the originals anymore. These are the movies. This is it. And you're like, well, okay, it's one thing to be like, hey, here's a new version. Like, I updated some stuff because, like, this was stuff I would have done back then if I had the chance. Isn't this cool? It's a whole other thing to go like, no, this is it.
That's a person that struggles deeply with rejection of thought and ideas. It's because wild. So much of the movie, so much of Star Wars is an accident. It is. It's time constraints, budget constraints, shots that just weren't, that they didn't get. It's saved and salvaged in editing with a great composer and someone that understands how to take, we got a guy going, and they didn't have enough frames of a sand person shaking a weapon up and down. The editor had to add an extra loop of it just to get enough time in of this guy going, they used every frame that they could, every film cell that was possible and salvageable that was necessary for the story is in it. And some of that, and stuff that he didn't, that he couldn't get.
And
stuff
it's
that
so
didn't
weird
work
and like in, to weirdly him. Insecure to go back and like suggest that the movies would have been so much better with all this other stuff. But it's like, hey, you'd realize these are some of the most popular movies ever released.
It is an ego thing. Yeah, I love the man, but it's an ego thing because so many of the ideas and so many of the things that work don't belong to him. Uh-huh. They belong to editors. They belong to cinematographers. And this, the prequels were a chance to use he had a conceptualization of the world that he wanted, and he could create it entirely within a green box on a soundstage that would be only every frame, only every look and picture that was in his own mind. It was total control. You see him behind the scenes sitting in a chair in a green room with actors acting against nothing. It's madness. Because he has in his mind what the picture is going to be, and it is totally auteurship. And the prequels are difficult for me because of that. There are not a lot of other ideas there, and that's why there are good ideas as he would come up with them, of course, as he came up with the good ideas in the original trilogy, but the other good ideas that would have been there with other creators' input and other actors' input and other stunt coordinators' input and other budgetary constraints inputs are not there,
mm-hmm.
and they are missing.
So, yeah. So that takes us to prequels because I think that's a really good analysis of like why another reason why the special editions are so disappointing.
There's no collaboration
because
there.
He's just kind of taking over and going, my movies. And really by that point, they were our movies too, which is kind of the point of that documentary, The People versus George Lucas.
Also watch that.
Like, hey, it doesn't belong to you anymore, bud. Like if Da Vinci goes, no, you guys, if he came back to life and went, actually, I think I can make the Mona Lisa better, we'd be like, hey,
she's
hey,
not
hey,
smiling
hey.
Enough, you know, she, I gotta work
look,
on
I it. Fixed it. Look.
I'm gonna add an alien here.
Or he makes it even more photorealistic. Like, yeah. She really looks real now.
This is what I imagined
look,
when
she,
I
saw this is her now, you know, it's, and we're like, we didn't, that's not why we liked it, you know? And also, it's the most popular painting of all time, so chill. You know,
yes.
But also he wasn't collaborating with someone else who like told him that this was the, you know, so there, I think that's really interesting that the ego getting in the way of just allowing the thing to be successful as it is. And then, if you're going to make the prequels anyway, it's like all that stuff you wanted to do, do it on these movies. Don't go back. And again, seeing those movies in the theater as a little kid
still
was
wonderful.
Such a gift. It was so wonderful, and I didn't really know any better, and I just loved it. I loved every second of it. And then just like I loved The Phantom Menace as an 11-year-old kid, I was so excited. I think I got out of school that day to go see the movie. I got like checked out of school and got to go watch it.
Must thank my parents for this. Every release of a Star Wars film, my dad signed me out of school as though I were sick so that I could go see the movie.
Oh.
Everyone. Also, the Lord of the Rings films.
Oh, cool.
The original
cool.
Peter Jackson trilogy.
Yeah.
So there were 6 times, if any of my teachers are listening, that I said I was sick. I was not. I was watching a movie. So, and it was awesome.
I hope one of your like elementary school teachers is listening to this and they're like, no!
Damn it!
Yeah. Uh-huh.
She had so much learning to do.
We need to do a retroactive truancy on her citizenship.
Totally. Yeah, totally worth
grade.
It.
So the prequels. Okay, so here we go.
Yeah, so like the reflection of the other of the other series is uh-huh. coming out of Vietnam,
which it is worth mentioning that you can watch George Lucas in interviews right after the first one was released when they ask him what his plans are with this, and he says, "I want to do 3 mirror trilogies, like 3 trilogies over 40 years that mirror each other." So this isn't just like the idea that this is just a cash grab. I mean, this really was part of the blueprint,
was to
go through this way from the get-go, and it sounded like a crazy idea, but here we are. Number 9's coming out.
It's coming.
In a week.
Ooh.
And it's the capstone of the 3rd Mirror Trilogy. It feels a little bit weird that it's out of his hands now. Also, kind of a relief. Thank God it's out of his hands so that he can't... continue to do what he wants to do, you know. Again, it's such a weird thing. It's like, thank you for creating this, but also you needed to be stopped. And anyway, so we got the original trilogy, that symbology.
Yeah,
prequels.
I feel like so much of it, and it made more sense to me. I'll give this example. When I went to go see Revenge of the Sith, by now, oh my goodness gracious, I was a tad bit older.
He's like 15 or 16.
We got 99, we got 2001, and then we got 2003 for the releases.
That was 2003, so 15, 16?
15. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I felt so, yeah. It's strange to think about that, how much growing I did between the releases of those films.
Mm-hmm.
But, after Revenge of the Sith, there is...
Seriously, though, I was young enough to really genuinely enjoy
Phantom
Menace, Jar Jar and
just
all.
Just as it was.
And I loved it, loved the pod race. By episode 2, I was like, this is kind of corny. And then by the 3rd one, I at least...
You re-engaged.
I was like, well, thanks for at least getting it. I wanted it more dark. And it was more dark, but I just didn't like Hayden Christensen. But there was a lot of growth in those 3 movies.
Absolutely. Yeah. I totally agree.
From me and from you.
I really remember the strongest was Obi-Wan. You know, it's Anakin and Obi-Wan in that final battle on Mustafar.
He's, I think, the best performance of all three movies is Ewan McGregor. He brings it.
Well, I know that.
He's the only one that really is capable to make that awful dialogue work. But it's that thing of, we were talking about with the first one, like, how do you get these people to commit to this ridiculous material so well? And it's so hard for great actors are in the prequel. Samuel Jackson, Natalie Portman's a great actor.
Wonderful.
She's a really wonderful actor. And she's not very good in those movies. She's very wooden. I don't think that she's bad. I think that the character's not well done.
She's not able to release herself from that. And it wasn't reflective of Carrie Fisher. Leia is Carrie Fisher. Carrie Fisher is Leia. Uh-huh. I did not get that with Natalie Portman. Natalie Portman is a great actor. You give her the right role. Hell, if you want to go watch someone become someone, go watch Jackie.
Oh, it's amazing.
Give someone the right role, and then they're an actor with certain tools.
What if we had gotten a Padme that was more akin to her character in Garden State? More personality and more, you know, that same thing where you said Carrie Fisher, like Leia is Carrie Fisher.
I would have loved to have had Natalie Portman as, yeah, I would love to have that.
It feels like her. It feels like an actor who's upset about the dialogue.
It is the performance of a young woman who is being constrained in this way, mm-hmm, by another man's interpretation of what she's supposed to be. Like George Lucas is saying, this is supposed to be the romantic. She is the Eve to this Adam. She is the reason. She is beautiful, intelligent, and graceful, and all of these things that are perfection that would sway a man that was so committed to his faith and pull him away from that.
And he's totally missing this big opportunity that we've talked about, where it's like you have this massive opportunity to have this person be the mother of Princess Leia.
Yeah,
like,
where did she get that sass?
Yeah, like you have the opportunity to show where all that personality comes from, and all you can think of is this
she
is
better
the
be
romantic
beautiful.
Foil the beautiful foil
I
to
love
Darth
the
Vader.
Water
yeah
it's I'll always...
I hate sand. Oh my goodness.
Oh, it's just, yeah, I hate sand and I love water. That's
Anakin,
what I got from the relationship.
Breaking my heart. Like, just these lines that they have that are, but then it's like, how does Ewan McGregor make it seem like
it works. It totally works.
He kills it. He crushes it. His scenes, you're like, okay, this guy's doing real stuff. Christopher Lee has some stuff that's kind of nice.
Oh, also great.
You know?
But I think that they came up
again
from a
different... absurd character name ever, Count Dooku. like the most ridiculous, with his weird dueling
Can
lightsaber.
Can we thank Christopher Lee for Count Dooku and Sauron?
And Saruman. Thank you, Christopher Lee.
Yes. I misspoke. I mean Saruman and the White Hand. Mm-hmm. Baddie in two different trilogies.
Very
for
different
me.
Characters, but he's such a great.
So we'll thank villain. Him. Little hands for Christopher Lee. We miss him. But yes, so Ewan buys in. I think it's really difficult for young actors. Natalie Portman in Phantom Menace, very young actress. Hayden Christensen. Jake Lloyd in the Phantom Menace, child. Hayden Christensen, a young actor. They don't have the benefit of certain schools of training, I don't think, to go ahead and create a world out of a green space.
Who
a
does?
Green, yes.
I mean...
And I think that the ones that are not... That look like they're not...
Especially at that time, it hadn't been done before.
No.
No one... This is not how movies were made. It's getting more and more common. And Ian McKellen's talked about it on the set of the Hobbit movies, where he's like... Hey, we used to be working on sets, and now even in the original, like the Lord
the
of the
original-
Rings trilogy, we were on sets, and now I'm.
I honestly, I'll be. I'm. You know, I may be crucified for this. I can't. I don't like the Hobbit series.
No,
at
they're
all.
Not good. I don't like them at all. I don't like any one of the three. I like parts of all three of them. I like Martin Freeman's performance.
He's lovely. He's a wonderful.
You know, I like parts, but I haven't seen the third one. Haven't seen.
Don't even
I
bother.
Didn't care.
Yeah, no,
I didn't care.
I just couldn't. I couldn't do it. You did these other movies. You could have done this one in one or two.
Should have been one movie.
Then again, you know, no sets. They just. It's like they learned nothing. Have you learned nothing? Am I a joke to you?
Seriously, it was another thing where it looks like Star Wars, where it's like, hey, did you not realize that
what people liked?
That we loved the they called them bigatures. Like we loved that shit. We. we loved that Minas Tirith was a real thing that you built. That crazy cool white city was like, yeah, obviously we know it wasn't that big in real life, but that it was real.
It was so awesome.
Like, we loved that. And then you watch the Hobbit movies and you're just like, so you just, even all the orcs that used to be actors in makeup
wonderful
are
actors
now CG?
I know.
Why did you think that that's what we wanted? Why did you think that that's, that was the better move? And I think it's partially just kind of laziness and wanting to pump things out faster. And that was an example of that. But because I can't imagine
that's
that they thought that it was better.
That's what
Whereas
we get with
George
the prequels.
Lucas seems to think that it was better.
He really believed that. He bought into this. I think he's always been someone that is on the cut. I mean, if you look at his short film, THX 1193, he's on the cutting edge of technology in film at all times. He's pushing thresholds. And this was another threshold push, that we can create a digital environment that looks exactly like what we picture in our minds. Look at the beautiful original paintings and an artwork that was designed by Ralph McQuarrie for the original Star Wars.
Yeah.
And those paintings are the paintings that are the backgrounds of the prequel trilogy. He was trying to give us what he envisioned. But unfortunately, it looks fake and it's not real.
It looks
and
like Space Jam.
Yes.
Like, it looks like real actors in
against
cartoon
animated
world.
Cells, and that's what they are.
And that's, I mean, it's fine when it's maybe one or two things coming into the shot, but when the entire environment is rendered digitally and the only real thing is the actor,
yes,
it's so, especially then, it was so glaringly obvious. Their shadows looked like cartoon shadows. And I mean, it's so bizarre too, because even in episode one in The Phantom Menace, there's lots of big sets, really big sets,
yeah,
like hangars and things like that.
Yeah, they're back in Tunisia for Tatooine.
Yeah, that hangar where they start the duel with
that's a
like
nice big,
that big door that opens, that big bay door that opens and everything, like that's really cool, that those big sets and stuff. And obviously, you know, they go onto that bridge where that's all CG, but like that stuff even feels, because it's married with the practical sets.
Do you want to know my favorite shot in all of Phantom Menace? It's very strange, and everyone always asks me, like, why that? And I when I was even little, I couldn't explain it, but now I can explain it. My favorite shot in all of Phantom Menace is when Padme Amidala, Queen Amidala at that point, is with her guard and they're trying to break back into the throne room.
Mm-hmm.
And they all line up and they all shoot these little wire guns up into the
yeah.
air, and the wire guns catch up onto the windows, and the stuntman and the stuntwoman portraying
yeah.
her get, they all launch up into the thing. And I was like, oh. When as a kid, I thought that was amazing. And I watched it again. It's like, I thought that was amazing. It's my favorite shot in the thing because there's stunt people
real.
Doing that with wires. And it looks awesome. It
yeah.
was a girl on an adventure.
Yeah.
She was taking back her throne and I was all for it.
Yeah.
And so those kinds of moments, and they filter through, and there could have been so many more. There were so many opportunities for these moments. And it is a shame that there aren't more. But I do appreciate them for what they are. And I like what I was saying about like that fight on Mustafar. The thing that stuck out to me the most was a line reading of, you know, if you're not with me, you're against me. And Obi-Wan said that, you know, that's the way Siths speak.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those only Siths speak in absolutes.
Mm-hmm.
And he replies, you know, back that it's interesting to me because that was an absolute reflection of the times. People were bored by the C-SPAN-esque shots of Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones of these Senates deciding on whether or not they're going to build armies and go
talking
to war.
Talking about trade routes. And,
yes.
Yeah.
But this was all what was broiling even before the attack in New York on September 11th
mm-hmm.
that changed everything. War was broiling. We had, you know, with in the Middle East, things were heating up. Terrorist attacks throughout the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we after that attack, you had the speech by President Bush that would say, like, if you're not with us, you're against us. And that was co-opted into the Revenge of the Sith film, and only Sith speak in absolutes. And that there was a big push. My dad, who was very conservative, was constantly listening to conservative talk radio. There was a big push to not go and support the film because it was an obvious attack on conservative politics and the ideology of going out and rooting out terrorism in every form. And I remember listening to that and I thought, oh, okay. Well, here we go. This is what this trilogy is about.
Mm-hmm.
This trilogy is about is the moment. This trilogy culminates in a quiet moment when Padme says, "So this is how democracy dies," mm-hmm. to thunderous applause. That wow. is what that trilogy is about. And it's, I wish that it had been executed better, because there are so many powerful ideas in that yeah. core of that trilogy.
It all gets lost in the wash of too much CGI, and you know, we weren't really ready technologically for the pushes he was trying to make. And
yeah,
because you even the leap from episode one to episode two is so massive with the use
yeah.
of CGI.
There is,
it's
yeah.
such a massive, it's like there was so much in episode one, and then it's almost the entire, it's almost like
the whole movie,
the entire movie is digital in Attack of the Clones. And it seems like they scale it back a touch. Well, not even really. The opening war sequence for
that that one
Revenge
shot
of the Sith is just like, you're just
my mind is, it's so dense, every frame is yeah, filled with something.
And I mean, it was getting to a place visually where it was getting better and cleaner and crisper, so it was getting really impressive just artistically. But I think that the consensus, yeah, from the, that is disappointing that that theme wasn't heard. Because I think that what it all got washed under was everyone just going like, it's too much with the fake shit. We want a return to the nostalgia of the original trilogy, which I think brings us to him kind of losing the job.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily him losing the job. It's him deciding to sell. But really, it's kind of like, the reins get taken away, and that leads us into the next trilogy.
Which is,
we get all this nostalgia, we get all these real sets and practical effects.
Oh, shooting on film, and it's beautiful.
You know, and shooting on film, and it's like this. I remember seeing that episode 7 in theaters, and I had such a low bar. I was like, all I want is for this to just be enjoyable. I just want it to just, I'm not asking for much here. I just want it to be like an enjoyable, solid movie that I can like kind of sit down and have a good time at. And I was so pleased. I was just so pleased. And I was also, I had no idea that I cared so much, because I was so shocked at the way I burst into tears when, spoiler, but really not, how the hell have you not seen it, when Ben stabs his dad. I burst into tears in the theater, and I was like, I had no idea I cared that much. I had no idea yeah. I cared this much about this character. But it was also like, I never came close to anything with that level of emotion in any of the prequel movies. Most of those movies, when I saw them in the theaters, well, the first Phantom Menace, I was just pleased as punch. I was very excited.
Oh, pod racing is the shit. Yeah. I had the N64 game yeah. to pod racer.
Oh yeah, it was awesome. That game was awesome.
Oh yeah.
But two and three, I was very disappointed. I remember being in the theater and just being like, damn it, this kind of sucks, and not enjoying myself. It was just so nice to enjoy a Star Wars movie again. So when yeah. 7 hit, I was just so thrilled to enjoy a Star Wars movie. That's how I felt most of the movie. And then I had no idea that I was going to feel the emotional hit that I felt. And it felt like I got a whole new lease on this universe. Like, it felt like the game's back on, baby.
Yes, it's like, true. All of it.
It's true. All of it. Even for the trailer, when he said that, chills. Like, are you kidding me? It's Han Solo looking at them going like, the Force is real. That guy that didn't, again, going back to the Force, that guy that didn't believe in the Force. And I felt like, we're going to get back to the Force. Because the Force really felt like it got fucked up for me again in the prequels. Like, the Force, with the Midichlorians, everything felt like we got off track. Like, the lightsabers and the Force were used so sparingly in those first three movies.
Yeah.
And they are everywhere in the prequels. The Force and lightsabers are just used for everything. Like,
because they're the coolest part of the movies.
But yeah, like, Jedis are just moving everything with the Force, jumping high, and like, you know, and it's like,
I totally...
We need this to be a special thing, not just this thing that
you don't like Yoda jumping around like a little
the coolest thing ever. When I was so I remember, I think I said to my brother after we saw Attack of the Clones, I was like, that whole movie was worth it for Yoda fighting Count Dooku at the end, because that's the coolest shit in the world. But even though it's like, it's pretty silly.
And then he pulls out his cane again.
Oh yeah, and the whipping the lightsaber to his hand with the Force, like pulling, you know, like, but again, I watch it as an older person, as an adult, I'm like, this is silly. Like, this feels like almost a parody of itself, you know? So, okay, I'm mostly pushing us forward because I feel like we have so much to get through.
We do.
And I want to move into to Disneyverse. Disney takes over. Episode 7, what was your reaction to the new universe?
A lot of feelings.
Was it similar to my experience, or were you disappointed, or...
It was very similar to yours. The minute there was so much real space that I saw in the opening shots. Mm-hmm. We get to meet our new lead, really, our new hero. After meeting Rey, mm-hmm. Meeting our scavenger, the opening we hear the cavernous echo of this Star Destroyer. So right in the beginning, we know that we're mining the old for the new.
Yeah.
And it's real. It's just, the Star Destroyer is there. There's like a physical set for it. You see the glow of these eyes and these goggles as she's and the light as she's moving things around, and then mm-hmm. and then the chains. You hear the sound of the chains as she's coming down. It's all physical. It's all real.
Yeah.
Then we watch her get into a speeder, and after she's slid down, she's like, they're back in Tunisia. She slid all the way down the sand for forever on a real a real stunt. Walks into a speeder that is actually there, a physical thing. It's all so physical and visceral that I was just I was blown away again. My heart was already immediately in it.
And in one sense, it's fan service, because we had been saying through 3 movies, this is not what makes Star Wars Star Wars. Please stop doing this. Please stop. Not everything needs to be CGI. So in some ways, it's fan service to go, is this what you want? But in other ways, it's like, there's a logic behind this, because the place was real. The cantina in Tatooine was a real place with like, and I can tell the difference between the real place and the fan. And I know that it's a set, but like, it...
The reaction.
You start
time
Force Awakens, and right away, I felt like we're in good hands.
Yes, I felt
right
so
away,
good.
I felt like this instantly feels like a return to form.
And
this
when she's,
feels,
I know Jakku is so,
and it's got all the good stuff of the what technology
can
bring.
Oh, absolutely.
You get that really great Millennium Falcon TIE fighter chase, like all the good stuff that CGI can bring. It's that way of like, this is what I would have hoped an updated Star Wars would look like. Not everything CG, but the same feeling, but like, and since
combinations of
and
things.
Since film has progressed and everything, now overlaying the CGI onto the real sets looks good, rather than the special edition where like it looks weird to overlay it onto 70s film grain. Now it all blends, it all like feels
It feels natural.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I knew right away that I was going to love the film when I watched a shot of Rey cleaning some metal that she'd scavenged, and she looks up and sees a very old woman that is doing the same thing, is cleaning, and Rey looks at her, contemplates, there's no sound, there's no dialogue there, it's just watching her watch and process, and then being slapped and told to get back to work, and she immediately does, and I knew right away, like, oh, look, visual storytelling. We get to see a young woman who knows that if she stays in this exact place doing this exact same thing for the rest of her life, she's going to end up just like this sweet old woman across from her that has done nothing except clean little metal parts for mean aliens. It's so refreshing. Mm-hmm. After the kind of storytelling that was used in the prequels to allow actors to tell me what's going on in their minds.
And that's the other thing, too, is all of a sudden I've got a bunch of actors who are doing really good work, too.
Yeah.
It's not just like trying to mine through the performances for like who's doing a good job, who's making the dialogue work, but it's like I'm liking everyone. I'm liking Oscar Isaac. I love Oscar Isaac.
Yeah, he's great.
I'm
so much fun, and that opening sequence is so fun.
I'm loving Daisy Ridley's work. I'm loving seeing Harrison Ford back, and he's like just totally bought in as like this older version of this classic character. And then My personal favorite performance of these movies is
Adam Driver.
Adam, where the fuck have you been? Like, you know, the guy from Girls. And I just was so... I remember when he was announced, when they cast him, and like seeing production photos early of him and being like, they cast this dude? They cast this weird guy with the weird voice from like... this like, hey, it's me, blah, blah, blah. And then, but watching the movie, I was like, oh my God, this dude's taking this seriously. Like, this dude's for real.
Yeah.
This dude is, I mean, that scene between him and his dad is
so powerful.
Oh, it's incredible. But yeah, I mean, everyone in the movie is doing excellent work. And yes. Like, so that's another thing too, where I'm like, great. I don't have to like get over so-and-so's performance. I don't have to be like, oh my God, like Hayden Christensen sucks at acting, but whatever. Ewan McGregor's doing a good job. You know? So yeah, I don't know. Yeah, just it's so
refreshing was the word for me. To see I was excited.
A good movie. And then even when people were going in on the flaws, oh, it's just a retread of A New Hope, all this stuff, I'm like, look, and my instant response was, if you want to just poke holes in a Star Wars movie, we can go through every single one of them one by one. And just talk about all the dumb shit.
Yeah, like, if you're going to call Rey a Mary Sue, let's go back and look at Luke a little bit.
Yeah, let's go look at, let's just go through all, but like, these movies have always been, when they're working their best, you should be able to sit back, relax, and just enjoy yourself. And be able to follow it without anything getting in the way because it's too glaringly, yes, like, annoying. And I think that people have built it up into this thing where, like, now they want perfect movies. They demand
perfection. Yes, everything has to be right. And it's like, well, they movies just it. Aren't like that. Yeah, and they're still Ewoks and Jedi.
Yeah, and the original three aren't like that.
Yeah.
You know, they're also movies that have their fair share of, I mean, the timeline issues in Empire Strikes Back. Like, how long is he on Dagobah? And
you're right.
Nothing quite lines up, you know, timeline wise. But we just, if you can go with it, most people think that's the best one.
Oh God, it's so good.
And you know, that's my next question. Actually, is well, first of all, let's stay with Disneyverse, and then we'll get to there. Disneyverse. So we're both very excited. I think most people are pretty excited and pretty. Back on board with Force Awakens, even though there's criticism that comes out afterward. There's people kind of going back and looking at it with a real critical eye.
They comb the desert.
Yeah, yep, exactly. Spaceball style. Have you ever seen Spaceballs?
Oh, of course.
It's awesome. Yeah. We ain't found shit. But 8 comes along, and again, I was thrilled because I love Rian Johnson, and I'm like, you get J.J. Abrams, J.J. kills it, now you're going to get Rian Johnson, Looper.
He's going to bring a whole new edge to it, right?
And we're back to division. We're back to, like, pretty heated division in the fandom. Yeah.
I'm fine with. It wasn't like Empire or Jedi, either of them were, I guess I can't call it Jedi anymore because we have Last Jedi, so I can't I'm gonna have to get a new nomenclature. So it wasn't like Empire or Return. Either one of them were perfectly received right when they came out. It's, you know, there's gonna be, again, if when a fandom is that invested,
I don't think people realize that the Empire Strikes Back was not well received,
right?
And it's considered
the best in the canon.
I've told my brother hates the Last Jedi. My brother hates to the point where it almost ruined all of Star Wars for him. He gets so upset about what he considers to be the gross mistreatment.
He doesn't see the beauty of some of the cinematography, the allusion to Japanese cinema. He
can't get over the mistreatment of Luke Skywalker.
Yoda was Yoda goes from most powerful Jedi to a dude who's like trying to steal Luke's food and going
to a goofy Muppet.
Excuse me, but that is what this. If we're circling back, that's what happens to our Jedi master.
So I told him this. I've talked to people about this. That remember, these are supposed to be mirror trilogies. So when you say, "Well, Episode 7 was a little bit too much like A New Hope," it's like, well, that's not by accident. That's on purpose. There are direct
parallels,
mirroring images,
and
that even exists in the prequels. Like that, these are intended to mirror each other. They're not intended to be direct ripoffs of each other. And I think that there's more than enough original content in 7 and 8 to justify their existence as standalone movies, particularly from what I think is their greatest strength, the new characters.
Oh, yes.
That we just have like new characters to follow and like new people to invest in, who I think are all very interesting, and
Well, if we have our parallels there, then we have Rey as Luke, we have Poe as Han, And that makes Finn our Princess Leia, yeah. which I'm a little excited about. Uh-huh. We'll see what happens with Poe and Finn, but, you know, that's just
And
me.
Who's his new love interest, Finn's new, what's her name?
Oh, Rose.
Rose. Rose, who stops Finn from saving everyone so that she can kiss him.
You don't know that for sure.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there are things that...
he might end up saving the world, yeah, and hey. She saved him.
And she saved him so that he can be the one to possibly... And that's the other thing, too, is, like, people were freaking out about all this plot stuff that got revealed in 8. Like, that's what it is. They're like, so she's just nobody? And I'm like, hey, we don't know that yet. We don't know.
He's convincing her of this.
It sounds an awful lot like he's lying to her in that scene. But also, like, people were pissed. Like, so Snoke doesn't matter? And my answer to that is, the Emperor wasn't the main villain of the original trilogy. Darth Vader is.
Right.
And Kylo Ren is Darth Vader. So, yeah, you're getting all, who's Snoke? We never knew who the fuck the Emperor was in 4, 5, and 6. We never, like, knew where this guy came from. He was just this guy.
This is just an incredible reinterpretation of basically of the young blood saying who has much more capability of directly influencing our hero. Yeah. Saying, I'm taking over.
I thought that was so badass. I remember in the theater instantly thinking, that's so cool. For the last year, everyone's been thinking, who is Snoke? You know who he is? Fucking no one next to Kylo Ren.
Exactly.
Like, and that's the answer, is it's like, who is this guy? It's like, no, remember, the real villain is right here, right in front of you. And so this person that you're looking at is a total red herring, and that's cool storytelling. I'm totally all here for that. And also, again, this movie mirrors Empire in so, so, so many ways. Down to, of course, the setting of, like, the climax, which is just such a direct visual allusion to Hoth, and doing that kind of flip of, like, the beginning at the end, and all this stuff. There's so much visual symmetry and storytelling that's so wonderful in that movie. I think part of the outrage, well, some of it comes from people like my brother who were just disappointed that his favorite character didn't get the send-off that he had in his mind. That thing we were talking about earlier with you have a way that it goes in your imagination, and then...
I think it was the most fitting and beautiful celebration of who Luke had come to be.
Yeah.
And that you could possibly have. Talk about a send-off.
Yeah.
This character who has the mentorship of his hero, of Obi-Wan, which ended for him... midway through New Hope, when he collapses and disappears and becomes a part of the Force and more powerful than Darth Vader could ever possibly imagine, that is what he screams no when that happens. He screams it because he doesn't understand. He doesn't understand that there is a non-physical realm that this person can still exist in and commune with him because he has mastered the non-physical within himself to share. And then you have Luke, who becomes so masterful in this. In that same practice, he has projected himself, images of himself, enough to save the next generation, and allows himself to not. He does not go down violently. He does not go quietly into that good night. He goes quietly into a dissipation, into an integration with the Force around him.
He goes out very much the same way his mentor did.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it's this very like tranquil, peaceful. Sacrifice.
And if that's not a send-off that reflects who he is as a character, I don't know what is.
I think that people like my brother wanted a really awesome action sequence where Luke goes
that
in
would be and, totally and, against what the Force represents.
Yeah, and he goes in and he fights Snoke and he fights Kylo and he kills everyone. And I'm like, again, a few things you have to remember. These movies aren't his anymore. He had his trilogy. He is a character, big character, major character in this movie, but we have a clear-cut new protagonist. It's not him. So he can't be the one to come in and wave his lightsaber around and kill everyone.
It's shocking to me that anyone would want that.
Yeah. And my brother's response is, he's the greatest hero of in the history of cinema. How can it not be him who saves the day? And I'm like, hey, you might be right that he's one of the greatest heroes in the history of cinema. Like, you have a really good point there. But clearly, this trilogy is not his trilogy to be the hero.
If he believes that Luke wanted to go out or should have gone out in some sort of epic battle, then I am shocked that he is a believer and a lover of that character, because I think he fails to understand him.
I agree with you. And if he listens to this episode,
he's going to be very angry.
Oh, he almost can't talk about that movie because he's so upset. He named his son Luke because he loves the character so much. So there's that reason. There's some people who just felt like their love of the characters or of the fandom wasn't served by the movie. And then there's the, anti-SJW reason. Which is the whole other reason where, like, people saw purple hair on Laura Dern and they were like, fuck no. Like, I am, like, absolutely not.
Fame on who? Yeah, it just destroys their love of the series.
There's people, so I'm loving Watchmen right now, and there's people who like hate the series because it's woke, and I'm like, hey, just because Watchmen's dealing with the reality of the KKK and like racism in America doesn't mean that they're trying to virtue signal or like,
why would you want to be asleep to that?
Yeah, it's like Watchmen always has, the comic book series always did deal with, even though it's an alternate version of American history, it always did deal with real social issues. That's what kind of made it a revolutionary graphic novel, was that like how seriously it dealt with its subject matter. And so this updated series is dealing with the history of racism in America and like the inherited trauma through generations of racism and stuff. And everyone that sees it is like, well, these anti-SJW types are seeing it and going like, oh, so Watchmen got woke now. And I'm like,
did we get this much pushback from Bryan Singer's first X-Men when Ian McKellen showed with that amazing opening of that movie, by the way, of and that and the allusion to that and
being
the
separated from his family
at the internment camp, and then he shows off like, you know, I've been marked once, I've had a tattoo
Holocaust
once.
Tattoo.
I know what people will do. Did we get that much pushback? Was that woke? Because again, comic book characters have always dealt with, especially let's go with the X-Men, but comic book characters have always dealt with these social issues. You have Stan Lee, your hero Stan Lee is what about as woke as you could be, quote unquote, trying to use their own language against
It really is so pathetic. It is so, because it's like you're not allowing yourself to enjoy this.
No, because it doesn't fit you.
And they get mad at the implication that people are like, you just don't like female heroes. And they're like, of course I like female heroes. I love Wonder Woman. And they'll say like, that's not true. This is just a poorly drawn female character. She's a Mary Sue. All this stuff. But it's like, yeah. But
can I say one thing? Yeah. That I was sold on Force Awakens and this character. That I was watching it, sitting in a third row of the cinema, while in front of me and a couple seats to my side, there was a family, including a young boy who was dressed in the original, I think it must have been a hand-me-down, original Anakin costume, or maybe, I don't know how much Disney was selling them to, but an Anakin costume, and had his lightsaber, his plastic lightsaber. He was so pumped, ready for this, and he's watching this film, and we get to this point when in Force Awakens, when Kylo and Rey are both, they're both trying to reach for that lightsaber, and it's going to fly into one of their hands, and it pulls out of the snow and it zooms by and it zooms past Kylo and right into a hand, and we hear the Force theme begin, and it lights up, and as it comes back and we reveal that it's by Rey's face, this little boy jumped up and was like, yes! He freaked out because it doesn't matter to him. This is not for you anymore. I'm sorry. If you think somehow that the gender of the character matters at all to this next generation, you've already lost. It's no longer your series.
Yeah. Yep. I think, yep, beautifully said. Perfectly said. Okay, so we're heading into...
Yeah, territory.
Yeah. So we got Last Jedi. There's all this stuff. I'm like, we could say so much more about...
Yeah, for sure.
About 7, about 8. We could do full episodes on all these, on every single one of these movies. But, yeah, we've got the gist of, like, what's going on right now. People are heading cautiously into the finish line here. There are people like my brother, who's, like, out after 8. He's out. But he's probably going to watch 9 in theaters because, like, you gotta finish the Skywalker saga.
I hope he holds firm and lets it go. We'll see.
I mean, it's such a massive event. I loved watching Avengers Endgame in theaters, but part of what made it so amazing was, and it doesn't hold the cultural heft that I think Star Wars does, but it still was this thing of like, this has never been done in the history of cinema.
A 10-year saga.
What they just did.
Yeah.
What Kevin Feige and Marvel Studios just did, starting with Iron Man, going to Endgame. It's really amazing. It's really a incredible, phenomenal feat, what they did, and how they did it so well. And with so few misfires through 22 movies. And yeah, they're still making movies, but like that feeling like the capstone, like that, the culmination in that movie and how well they executed it. Again, you can go through that whole entire series of 22 movies and poke holes all day long. It's, does it succeed at like moving you and taking you through the journey? And are you invested in the characters? And, you know, my answer to that is yes. But this here, episode 9 of the Skywalker saga, just feels like the fact that we're here, the fact that like it's happening. And again, there's going to be,
I've been waiting since I was 4 years old.
I think there's going to be that sadness of like, well, that's it, you know, and that's now how it goes. And that's the answer. And I think that's sort of what my brother experienced a little bit, was like, okay, so that's how Luke Skywalker's story ends, huh? And it's never going to live up to like whatever you had in your head for the way that it should go. And so there is sort of a sadness in that, but it's also like, this is it. And
the ones we love are never really gone.
Yeah. And like, hey, we still have to see what happens in this movie, you know, because I mean, I think there's going to be a lot of things that people were upset about that will be at least dealt with or, you know, brushed upon. But we're heading into this movie. Before we see this movie, I know this is sort of an unfair question to ask you because we haven't seen this movie yet. So before we see episode 9, best Star Wars movie. And this is a weighted question, including
anthology films. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because I know a lot of people are going to put Rogue One up there with Empire. I loved Rogue One. I do have some quibbles about it in ways that I don't think that others will. And just in terms of character and character development.
See, that's my answer is Rogue One.
Yeah.
I think it's the best movie that's been made.
I knew it.
Not that it's my favorite Star Wars movie. It's not my favorite Star Wars movie.
But it's the best Star Wars movie.
I think it's
movie.
The best movie they've made. I think it's like the best.
There is so much to be said about the incredible cinematography of that film. It looks better than any Star Wars movie that I have ever seen.
It attempts and accomplishes a lot of things thematically that I think are also pretty impressive for a movie in that canon. And like emotionally, it goes to places. I think my favorite Star Wars movie is probably Empire Strikes Back or...
Yes, I have to go with Empire as the best film.
Maybe
but...
even Return of the Jedi. I love Return of the Jedi.
Return of the
Jedi
is great.
I love Return of the Jedi.
I do. There's some great moments in Return of the Jedi. Mm-hmm. Second that, I mean, it's a little... I mean, people will complain till Kingdom Come about Last Jedi and Rose riding up with BB-8 on that chicken walker, but... No one's going to go back and say, like, that was really silly when that Ewok was driving that chicken walker in Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
Because no one wants to touch those original trilogies, and I get it. But try. Reach into a place in your heart where you forgive Return of the Jedi or Empire or New Hope for any silly things, and forgive the silly things, quote-unquote, that you see in the prequels and in the sequels.
Are
just
either
of
these new two in your list, like, up there?
As up there in the upper echelon? Uh-huh. It's hard for me. There are moments. There are moments of The Last Jedi that are so exquisite that, but maybe for reasons that are not appropriate to filmmaking, they are very subjective to me. They're not objective. There's a moment. It's the one that everyone hates when Leia. So I'm gonna go back a little teensy bit.
Mm-hmm.
I went to see Rogue One. Loved it, obviously.
Yeah.
2 days before Carrie Fisher passed.
Mm.
I watched it, watched that movie, watched the ending of that film when this rendition of Carrie Fisher, and everyone's going to say, you got to be objective, that's Leia. So, but it's the rendition of Carrie Fisher in her youth with her voice saying, hope.
Okay, listen, I don't know how and I don't know why, but somehow the end of this interview was cut off. And we got plenty of material, so it's not that big of a deal. But it is kind of a shame that you don't get to hear the story she was just about to tell. I reached out to her and I got her permission to paraphrase it because it really showed just how much this franchise means to her. Basically, she just talked about seeing the moment in The Last Jedi when Leia has just been killed in front of her son and the experience of realizing
that was it. That was the last time she was going to see Carrie Fisher as Leia on screen ever again. I had a similar experience in the theater. It was sudden and visceral, like an unexpected gut punch. And then the camera cuts to the seemingly lifeless body of General Organa floating through the void of space, and suddenly, a flicker of life flows through her, and she begins to fly back to the safety of the ship, driven by a miracle of the Force. It's a moment that signaled the end of any hope for the Disneyverse for many fans. But for Natalia, it wasn't all doom and gloom. It was just a simple, beautiful moment filled with hope. So when it comes to whether I think Star Wars is just cool lightsaber fights or something philosophically deeper, I think the answer for me is somewhere in between. What it means to the fans is clearly something deep and personal, but when I sit in the theater on Friday to finish this saga that I started so long ago, I'm not going to expect anything near cinematic perfection. I'm going to sit down determined to enjoy whatever JJ and his team have whipped up, knowing that it will almost certainly have many elements that I disagree with or that don't quite live up to the high mark Star Wars has in my heart. But I don't think I ever liked Star Wars because the movies were so narratively bulletproof or cinematically flawless. I liked it because of the way it made me feel. It made me feel like light was stronger than dark. Like there was meaning and purpose to life. It made me feel hope. People Pleaser is written, edited, produced, and hosted by me, Austin Archer, with original music also by me. Of course, the music on this episode was just covers from John Williams' score to Star Wars. Tune in next week when my guest will be, as I said at the beginning of the show, David Rosenblatt. You can find more of my projects at austin-archer.com or by searching Austin Archer on Apple Music and Spotify. You can hear more of my music there. You know, rate and subscribe, share this thing on Instagram and Facebook, let people know that you listen to the show, and I think that's everything, and thanks. Okay, bye-bye.
Go see a Star Wars.